Almost 100 years ago, in the late spring of 1921, Tulsa, Oklahoma erupted into the worst single incident of racial violence in American history. Over the course of 16 hours, mobs of white Tulsans looted and burned down the prosperous African-American community of Greenwood, known today as Black Wall Street. More than 1,000 homes and businesses were destroyed. Scores, possibly hundreds of people lost their lives. And it's estimated that around 10,000 residents were left homeless. But there was also another story, one that has never been told before. That is the story told in the new book, The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. Scott Ellsworth is the author, and he joins us this morning. Scott, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for asking me.
What brought you to this particular project?
Well, I'm a native Tulsan, born and raised in the city. And I can tell you in the 1960s, when I was growing up in Tulsa, you would occasionally hear older residents talk about something that we then called the Tulsa Race Riot. But, you know, even as a child, if you walked into the room, they would change the subject. So it piqued my interest early on. I later heard what I would have guessed would have been urban legends about bodies floating down the Arkansas River, or machine guns and airplanes. But this, you know, early on, I got the sense that my hometown had a skeleton in the closet.
How much did you know about it growing up in Tulsa?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I a couple of buddies and I went to the downtown Tulsa City County Library, and we spied something we had never seen before, which was a microfilm machine. And we were determined to use it, and we went over to it and started fiddling with the knots. And a librarian marched over, and rather than shoo us away, she instead taught us how to use the machine. And there were all these cabinets nearby with old reels of microfilm of issues of Tulsa's, you know, daily newspapers. And somehow I knew that June 1921 is when that thing happened. So the first thing we did is we put that roll into the machine, and we were just flabbergasted. I mean, these headlines of 100 people killed, city under martial law and all that. And we didn't, you know, have the wherewithal to figure all that stuff out as a 12-year-old. But I knew then that that something indeed had happened.
When it came to this book, and knowing that you have written about the Tulsa Race Massacre before, what was it in this book that you wanted to get to the bottom of?
Well, there were a couple things. One thing I realized, you know, the reason that, you know, even today people say, why haven't I heard of this thing before? What did it happen in the U.S.? It's because the story of the massacre was actively suppressed for 50 years. And then it's taken about another 50 years to get this story out. And, you know, I've been at this off and on for 45 of those past 50 years. And I realized I was probably one of the few people still around who could really tell that story. And I thought that rather than have that slip away, it was important to tell it. But I also wanted to let people know about things that are connected with it. We've been searching for the mass graves associated with the massacre for over 20 years now. And this past October, we discovered a mass grave in a Tulsa cemetery. We're going to begin exhuming that on June 1st. And there were some updates that I wanted to bring out as well.
I mean, one of the things that you talk about is that how difficult and frustrating it was to find accurate accounts of the massacre due to much of what you were just talking about, destruction of paperwork, news articles, written evidence, even the suppression of speech about the massacre for many decades. So once you decide to keep digging, are there just roadblocks after roadblocks, or eventually do the floodgates start to open?
Well, I would say there, you know, I certainly got used to roadblocks early on. And but if you just keep at something, I mean, this was such a huge event that eventually, you know, bits of light are going to brew. I also really have to give credit, and I do so in the groundbreaking, to, you know, this set of really courageous African-American massacre survivors and white eyewitnesses, you know, handfuls of them, who really kept the story alive. They helped to preserve it. And I was just lucky as a college, beginning as a college student in 1975, that some of these folks decided they would talk to me. And it could have been someone else. It happened to be me. But that was really the moment when we could help preserve the story. It's really because of the survivors that we actually know how this thing happened. And, you know, I wanted to do a book that also talked about them and honored them as well.
Back in 1975, you interviewed a African-American man named W.D. Williams, and it was an interview as an oral history from his home in Tulsa. What changed for you that day?
Oh, gosh, the whole world, my whole world changed that day. So I had heard of Mr. Williams. He was really Greenwood royalty. His family, his parents had been one of the wealthiest black families in town. They owned a movie theater, an automobile garage, a three-story office building. And I had difficulty trying to understand how the massacre actually began. And I'd heard about him. I called him up and asked him if I could speak with him. And he agreed, and it was just going to be an hour interview. And I think we were together for 4 hours. But on that, he had just been at all the right places at the right time. He had read the inflammatory coverage in the Tulsa Tribune that turned a simple, you know, innocent event in an elevator into this horrific rape attempt and all this stuff. He had watched as black World War One veterans had organized to stop the lynching of this young man at the courthouse. And he had stayed up all night helping, you know, reload his father's rifle and shotgun to help protect their businesses. So he had seen everything, and you know, he had been waiting all of his life, really, to tell this story to a journalist, a TV news crew, a college professor, and he sure as heck wasn't waiting for me, sort of a nobody, you know, college student. But he opened up to me, and once he realized I was serious and interested, he really opened the door. And then 3 summers later, he introduced me to other elderly African-American massacre survivors, all of whom had been adults in 1921, and they shared their stories with me as well. And it's because of those folks that we really know what happened.
Talk a little bit about what it was like for you to talk about those who survived and those ancestors who were impacted. Obviously, it's sensitive as a white Tulsan talking to these African Americans. What was that like for you, and what do you learn in that process?
Well, I got the good end of the deal, absolutely. And I ended up knowing other survivors in the 80s and 90s and, you know, and beyond, and became, you know, quite close with a number of them. And they, again, I think that they recognized that I was, you know, honest about wanting, you know, genuine, wanting to know what had happened. But, you know, I just got so much from them. I mean, this was a generation of people who had grown up during segregation, had become adults during segregation. You know, some of them had fought in World War II. They had supported the civil rights movement. They saw how, you know, legalized Jim Crow started to fall. They'd seen a lot of changes in their lives. And to me, they just taught me a lot about living and, you know, what was important. So I was just blessed in every way, you know, not simply to be their witness, but also, you know, just to get to know them and see what incredible lives that they had led.
When you go to Tulsa, how hard is it or how easy is it to find out information of how things unfolded that day?
Well, it's awfully easy now. You know, it took us a long time to get this story out, but, you know, there's, you know, throughout Greenwood, at least, there are memorials, markers, you know, plaques in the street where black-owned businesses that were destroyed during the massacre, you know, had been located. You know, there are art projects. And of course, as the centennial approaches, you know, there have been concerts, there's speeches, there's just a lot going on. It's safe to say that the story, you know, is finally getting out. Although I have to tell you that even to this day, I hear, you know, from people who say, why have I never heard of this before? This happened in the United States, in the middle of the country. You know, so it's taken a while. We haven't quite gotten into all the history books yet, but we're getting closer.
And historically speaking, 100 years really isn't that long ago.
No, not at all. I mean, that we still have three survivors of the massacre left. In fact, three of them, you know, testified in Congress, you know, a few days ago. And so, I mean, yes, it is. It is not that far away.
Scott Ellsworth is our guest this morning. The name of the book is The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. You mentioned this early on, but tell us that in October of 2020, you discover a mass grave that is thought to be connected to the 1921 massacre. What did you find? What do you know for sure? And what are the question marks that remain?
Right. So, and this has been the result of an effort that's been going on for off and on for 23 years. So we had learned through 20 years ago, we discovered, my associate discovered some ledgers in white-owned funeral homes that nobody had looked at in, you know, 80 years that proved that certain of those funeral homes buried at least 18 identified and unidentified African-American massacre victims in Oaklawn Cemetery, a city-owned cemetery in Tulsa. But all the cemetery records prior to the 1930s had disappeared, you know, which is common for a lot of stuff having to do with the massacre. And so we didn't know exactly where they were, but we were confident that they were there. In July, we made our first excavation based in part on using ground-penetrating radar and some other devices. We thought we had found a mass grave, but it turned out not to be. But in October, we tried a secondary location that we thought might be there, and we ended up discovering some dozen very plain pine box coffins. We believe that these are massacre victims. We believe that they're probably some of these 18 that we know about. So on June 1st, we're going to begin the exhumation process there of the site. You know, the coffins will be very carefully, you know, opened. The bones and human remains will be studied. The forensic scientist and osteologist, they'll be able to determine age and gender and, you know, racial characteristics, cause of death as well. We have to prove, of course, that they're massacre victims, but we should know that fairly easily. And then the plan is to, as quickly as possible, to rebury them with honor, probably in Greenwood itself, and then to memorialize them. And, you know, in my mind, you know, a memorial may be something along the lines of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington, because I think, you know, we might be able to identify some of these people from DNA, but I'm sure there's going to be some we will not be able to. So they will represent not simply victims of the Tulsa race massacre, but also, you know, victims of racial violence in all of American history.
Do you know, or is it suspected that there may be another mass grave site?
Oh yeah, I'm quite confident that massacre victims are buried in unmarked graves in at least 2 to 3 other locations in town. We've collected a fair amount of evidence about an area which is now called New Block Park in Tulsa. There's a nearby homeless camp called the Canes along the Arkansas River. I'm convinced that there was a trench dug with a steam shovel in which there may be as many as 50 or 60 bodies were buried. The question is whether we're going to be, I'm sure it's there. The question is whether we're going to be able to find it or not.
Scott Ellsworth is our guest this morning, and the new book is The Groundbreaking. Another issue, of course, is reparations, and I know it's something that you have worked on in sense of for survivors of the massacre and their descendants. Where does that work stand at this moment?
Well, I think it's if you ever want to get a argument going at a cocktail party in Tulsa, bring up reparations. It's a very divisive issue. There's people feel very strongly about it on one side or the other. And I think in all fairness, reparations in general as a subject is a very complicated issue. That said, I came to believe 20 plus years ago that the survivors of the massacre and their descendants do deserve some form of financial restitution for what happened. I mean, not only did people try to kill them, not only were their homes and businesses all burned down and destroyed, but the city government let them down, the state government let them down, the federal government let them down. There was not ever a federal investigation of the massacre. And insurance companies, you know, many of the business owners had insurance on their property and their homes as well. All the insurance companies, some of whom are around today, denied payments. So 20 years ago, the state of Oklahoma had a chance to pay some form of financial restitution to the 150 or so survivors. They did not do that. Instead, they gave them each a gold-plated medal. You know, we're down to maybe three survivors today, but we have a good sense who these descendants are. I don't think it'll be easy to do, but I think it's something that we need to do as a society.
How do the survivors and even their descendants feel about that issue?
Oh, the survivors and descendants were all, solidly 100% behind, you know, some form of compensation. But I have to tell you, you know, 20 years ago, I came to learn from the survivors that, you know, many of whom even at that point were in their 80s and, near the end of their lives. It wasn't so much that the money was going to change their lives personally in gigantic ways, but it was more the sense that this was something that was owed to them and had never been paid. I remember George Monroe, whose parents owned a roller skating rink in Tulsa that was burned during the massacre, and their home was burned as well, too. In fact, George hid under his parents' bed as the white rioters came into the room. One of them almost stepped on his hand. The rioters rifled through his parents' dresser looking for money or jewels, and then they set the curtains on fire. Luckily, George and his sister were able to get out in time. But he said it would mean a whole lot to him, and he thought a lot about his parents, what they had lost, how hard that was for him. I just think it's a question of right and wrong, and there's no question, you know, the Tulsa Race Massacre is a finite event. You know, there ultimately weren't that many people involved. You know, it just lasted for, you know, 14 or 16 hours, and I think it's something that we need to do.
Scott Ellsworth is the author of The Groundbreaking in American City and Its Search for Justice. What do you hope the book ultimately tells us and really opens readers up to understanding more about the massacre and the conversations that it can start?
Well, I think there's three or four things. I mean, it's going to be hard reading for some folks because there are some difficult subjects that are talked about here. But the massacre is also a story of resilience and human determination. I think we can learn a lot from these incredible survivors that I was lucky enough to know. But I also think, you know, right now in America, and in fact, to some degree across the world, we're going through this period of trying to figure out who we are as a nation, who our heroes are. You know, statues have been torn down, rightly or wrongly. Buildings are getting renamed, things like that. The funny thing about, you know, Tulsa Oklahoma is by far one of the most conservative states in the United States. And yet Tulsa, because it had this skeleton in its closet buried for so long, I think is in some ways ahead of the country in terms of trying to deal with these new questions about our history, what we should teach and what we shouldn't teach. So I think that there's hope in the book. I think it's also going to help spur conversations that should happen in every town. You know, what is it about our past that we aren't teaching? What is it that we need to teach? And hopefully it will help, that conversation nationally.
The centennial is upon us. How do you think we should reflect as we go through these next few days?
Wow, that's a really great question. I think it's just to reflect on, you know, these people and everything that they had to go through, how this horrific event happened. You know, the amazing thing about Greenwood is that it rebuilt itself. And There are people that say that the Greenwood of the 1940s was even greater than that of the 1920s. But this is a story about people, again, who persevered, who stuck it out, and were able to deal with adversity. And yet we're very proud Americans as well, too. I think we have a lot to learn from these folks, and I hope that my book, you know, helps spur some interest in them.
Scott Ellsworth teaches in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. His new book, The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice, it is published by Dutton. Scott Ellsworth, I thank you very much for sharing with us, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on the program.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. The book is published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.